NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. If approved, applications are typically funded the next business day or sooner. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit. Credit to the people.
Building a business may feel like a big jump, but OnDeck Small Business Loans can help keep you afloat. With lines of credit up to $100,000 and term loans up to $250,000, OnDeck lets you choose the loan that's right for your business. As a top-rated online small business lender, OnDeck's team of loan advisors can help you find the right business loan to fit your needs. Visit OnDeck.com for more information. Depending on certain loan attributes, your business loan may be issued by OnDeck or Celtic Bank. OnDeck does not lend in North Dakota. All loans and amounts subject to lender approval.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Ed, we're going to kick off now with our panel here, where we're discussing 2024 and what it means, and I suppose casting it forward into the year ahead. Are the foundations of something for 2025 being laid down over the last few months? We'll talk politics, of course. Let me just introduce you to our dissectors, here are professional dissectors. John Isle is the Deputy Business Editor with the Sunday Times Irish Edition. He's here. I'm also joined by Joan Mulville, who is an artist and digitalisation lead at Siemens, and Colm O'Gorman, who is a human rights campaigner and Irish Examiner columnist. You're all very welcome. Lockett's here if you're stuck, by the way. We need to get you three through. This is very selfish reasons. We need to keep you healthy. What becomes of you after that, I'm less concerned about. But I need you to stay upright for the next half an hour, or actually hour in total. Listen, you're all very welcome. We always hear this end of the year. This was a very unprecedented special year. And then you kind of go, but what, didn't you say that about the previous year? Mm. Every year is special. It's a bit like people's children. So, you know, you're picking out particular things or particular moments or milestones or quirks and so on. We're going to talk Irish politics for the first 10 or 15 minutes. Yes, we'll get to the Musks and Trump stuff. I can see all three of you. That's probably maybe where more of the interest is. But we do have domestic political things to overlook and have a review of. So let me talk about Irish politics first. Colm, I wanted to come to you on the referendums thing, which kind of everyone has kind of forgotten there was any referendums because they were quite a while ago. We had two amendments to the Constitution put down, both pretty much resoundingly defeated. Now, you know a thing or two about referendums. Mm. You've been around the block, if that's okay for me to say. You've been a winner in them. What went wrong on this one that you can remember back? Was it just a lack of good foundations underneath the campaign, in your view?
Well, there were two referendum proposals. One had to do with a redefinition of family within the Constitution in an effort to broaden it out beyond the married family to ensure that the protections that are accorded to families were available to all families and all family types. Seems like a sensible thing to do, doesn't it? I suppose the problem is that it was a very ill-considered and poorly developed proposal and was not at all well explained to people, so people didn't understand it. And, you know, if you ask people to change the Constitution, they do actually take it seriously. And if they don't understand what's the change that's being proposed, they're going to say no. I mean, it's that old...
So if in doubt, vote no.
If in doubt, vote no. And I think that one I thought might have passed, but actually it failed by 67.69% of people said no. The other proposal was to change the way in which, so it was called the care referendum, which initially when it was being talked about was talked about removing language that was sexist from the Constitution, language that defined, for many people, the language, it was language of its time, but it certainly defined women's role in a very particular way, that the women's role was a domestic role and a role within the home, and that needed to be changed. When that was thrashed around over a number of years, some interesting ideas came back. There was a constitutional convention that looked at it at one stage and they said, we shouldn't just delete it, rather we should make it gender neutral. So we should value care and we should say that the state should be committed to supporting care wherever care happens. The problem with this referendum was, and people talk about these referendums as if their defeat signals the end of any kind of liberalisation or any kind of a progressive approach to constitutional reform. The problem with the care referendum in particular was not only was it not progressive, it was deeply regressive. Instead of talking about supporting care in the home, and making it clear that the state had an obligation to support care and caregivers and those who might receive care. Instead, it made care a private concern. It essentially said that care needs to be provided, and however it's provided, it should be provided, but the state really doesn't have a role or any obligations.
We have Roderick O'Gorman, the now Green Party's reigning TD, saying this morning that he thinks the whole thing was badly conceived.
Yeah.
And the timing and the way it was sold in relation to International Women's Day, and I think what he's saying, it was kind of tokenistic, and the feeling was tokenism about it.
Yeah, he said that the only people enthusiastic for the referendums were himself, Leo Varadkar, and Eamon Ryan, that they were announced very suddenly without the preparatory work having been done, that a decision was made to announce the referendum on International Women's Day, and my department was told about that a week in advance, which seems fairly extraordinary. I'd love to know who made that decision. But the issue really is, I mean, I actually think what's more interesting in some ways about those referendums is the way that now they've been signalled as meaning something that actually I don't think they mean at all.
You think they're over-reading into it?
They're
over-contextualising.
They're being signalled now as a rejection of progressive thinking or of the liberalisation of society. And actually, I voted against the care referendum. I thought it was a deeply regressive idea. I publicly opposed the care referendum. Lots of people did. It was defeated by a huge vote.
Are you any the wiser about any of these referendums at this
stage? It's really interesting. I was sitting at a table with my cousin Jill and her husband last night. And they're two teenage daughters and, you know, all well-informed, you know, engaged citizens of this country, and including myself. And I'm going, yeah, I've talked about the referendum tomorrow. What were they again? It was this, and Colm, you nailed it. You just said, you know, they were ill-considered and vague. And that's kind of the memory that I have. Now, I will laugh and say, you've asked a menopausal woman onto a panel to talk about the year in review. And
Should I be worried?
I struggle to remember what happened last week a lot of the time. But actually, now I reflect back, I think that was the thing. There was a vagueness to them. And now that you mention again, Colm, I remember that patronising aspect of it being on International Women's Day, that you were suddenly a man emancipating us again. I'm going, you're all right, lads. We've got this covered.
Blokes, yeah.
I don't need it, you know? And so there was a lot of it that was just, it felt to me, and it feels to me increasingly, that we've got this, we've got governments coming into power and they've got a list of KPIs. How many bills can we pass in a term, and how many referenda can we have? Well, we must do at least one constitutional change per term. Well, you know, if it ain't broke sometimes. And it felt like it was rushed, that we needed to get a referendum in before the government, you know, folded and we had to have a general election.
I've got to deprive John of any opportunity to talk about the referendum. He's going to shunt him on a bit. He's all ready to go. I want to talk about something more mainstream, I suppose, which is the political centre. Okay, so this contention, John, is that the Irish election, compared to what happened in France, what's happening in the US, the centre held, moderation held, the tradition held. Yeah, there was one or two bits like the monk running and so on. But broadly speaking, the Irish were a little bit more sensible. They kind of went with what they know, etc. A, do you accept that contention? And B, if that is the case, is that a good thing or not?
I'm going to give you an ambivalent answer, Emmett. So yes, I mean, objectively, the centre held, right? We're essentially returning Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil to government. But I think what might be happening here is that the sort of upheaval is yet to come. I don't think Ireland is immune. Like, I think Ireland has a habit of thinking of itself as a kind
of... We're not special.
As a kind of a marginal player. We're not really part of the stream of European history. These kind of, you know, movements don't affect us. We have our own internal politics. I don't believe that. Like, we're all swimming in the same water. The same social media garbage bubbles up here, just like it does anywhere else. I think Ireland took a look at what happened in those November riots and got a bit of a fright and thought, I'm going to retreat. You know, we'll retreat now. We won't kind of mess around with anything that's going to sort of change the status quo. But I'm not sure how long that we can keep a lid on that, to be honest. And I think we consume so much American media here, so much British media, that stuff filters through. These ideas that originate elsewhere that aren't necessarily, you know, grown in the soil of Irish politics will nonetheless, I think, have an effect on how people understand their situations with relation to the economy and with relation to the political system.
And moderation is holding, but just for now.
Well, I don't disagree at all. I've always been a bit concerned, or very concerned, when I've heard commentators suggest that somehow we are exceptional in that respect, right? I remember having a debate with a well-known journalist on national television when the Irish Times published an alt-right lexicon, right? And almost glorified this notion of alt-rightism and that language as something that was kind of funny. And her response to me was, don't be silly, we're not the UK, we're not the US, we don't go to those places. And it's like, why do we believe we're that exceptional? you know, we are a collection of human beings who are as vulnerable to the same manipulations and prejudices and biases as anybody else. So I absolutely agree that
so
those
why
issues
not happen
present
this time
here.
Around then. Is it just a matter of timing, or is it?
Well, because I don't think it's taken hold here yet in the way that it might. That I still think it could. Mm. By the way, I think there were very significant efforts, particularly. I mean, one of the things that really frustrates me about public discourse in Ireland, in the political and media space, is how poorly it reflects where actually society is at a lot of the time. Mm. So, like, we had a year and a half of mainstream political correspondents. God, I just used the word mainstream. I hate to
the MSM.
Political correspondents telling us that immigration was going to be a huge issue. And they talked it into being a huge issue. And then every time that it could be presented as being something extreme, so the whole discourse became an extremist discourse rather than one that could have any kind of nuance or subtlety or thoughtfulness about it. Like, for example, the number of times that I would have said, no, I'm not saying that if anybody has a concern about the impact of migration on housing or on health or on public services here as a racist. I've never said that, and I'm not saying that. Those are particularly valid concerns. But you had to couch any conversation you wanted to have about that, because the way that the discourse was being presented in those spaces was one that was based on extremes. And we are not. People are not extremist in the main. And sometimes too much attention is given to the extreme position.
Mm. Before we come into this election, we were told, as Colm says, that migration is going to be very volatile. Mm. And then, of course, weeks later, everyone was writing these opinion articles going, this election is very dull. There's no news. There's no head. So which is it, right? I mean,
yeah, I think Colm makes a good point about, you know, how we present immigration in the media and how we almost stir up issues that may not actually be there. And to your point, John, like, in reality is we are no more immune to social media influences and manipulation than anybody else. And I specifically say social media influences because actually, as a country, historically, we probably have been somewhat immune because we didn't have access to global media all of the time. People were not consuming that all the time. But what social media has done successfully is managed to polarize, manipulate, and drive extremism in all society. And so we are now part of this global, you know,
soup
of media and where we're consuming it. So I think we have to have a real responsibility for how we talk about immigration. There's a whole debate on immigration that says it's really, really good for economies. We're all looking at, you know, aging populations. We need more people coming into the country with skills and whatever. But we keep positioning it as this negative thing and trying to drive up stories where there aren't any. Like, I remember being in studio here just before the general elections, and there was a journalist on with me, and we were talking about the monk, and she said, oh, well, you know, it's democracy. And I'm going, is it democracy, though, if you're giving a first-time independent candidate 3 pages in your paper? You're not doing that for
everyone else.
You're not doing that for every other independent first-time candidate. So sometimes we create problems and stir the pot because we'd like to create an interesting news day.
Just to say one thing in case it's getting missed here, I'm not saying that immigration is not an issue. Mm. We are now a country of very significant inward migration.
Yes.
We're a country with not just a housing crisis, but a housing catastrophe. We're a country in which our public services are really struggling despite our extraordinary levels of wealth right now. So of course, individual people and individual communities have questions about how they can absorb and support and accommodate more people arriving into their communities.
I want to talk about
those are perfectly reasonable questions.
Yeah, particularly because of John's professional current whole role. The money thing, right? I think, again, this is like our self-conception of ourselves as Irish people. We still think of ourselves as sort of the 1950s Irish, you know, the sort of, we're on the migrant boat to Britain, you know, La Masse and De Valera are in charge, and we're not very wealthy, you know.
But that was 1980s Ireland.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. I was there for that, right?
I was one of those people.
Despite what David Quinn said, it was apparently halcyon days. But we have this sort of self-image of ourselves as this broken down, kind of poor, backward place, and we're not very wealthy. And then you look at the numbers, and they can't be denied any longer. The surpluses, the two sovereign wealth funds. And I know there's the whole Trump thing coming and it is sustainable. But even if Trump destroyed the Irish economy tomorrow, those sovereign wealth funds will still have that money. The money is there. Yeah, it's in the bank, right? So our perception of ourselves, and this might go back to the migration thing, we see ourselves one way, but we're actually on a GDP per capita basis. We're pretty wealthy. Most people in Ireland, we have full employment, but we're sort of almost uncomfortable with that. It doesn't sort of fit the oppressed image. We're sort of like, yeah. we're wealthy Western European citizens, whether we like it or don't like it. I'm not saying everyone's having a great time and there's no social problems, but our perception of ourselves sometimes is at variance with the actual hard economic numbers.
I think that tension is at the center of what we were just talking about, that the chief political tension I see here is between our economic capacity and our administrative capacity to execute, right? And that's something I think that has to be learned and developed over a very long time. Like I do this terrible thing to myself when I travel in Europe, you know, I go to Amsterdam or something like that and I say, well, how do they do it? You know, well, they've been doing
colonialism.
And they've been doing it for 400 years, right? They've been a wealthy country for centuries as opposed to decades. So I think it's important to recognize that. So there is that issue of like accumulated wealth and that kind of like just the cultural expectation.
New money, old money type.
A little bit, yeah, a little bit. And you know, you see that Ireland isn't the only country that experiences that issue, right? So, you know, we're on paper richer than a place like Italy, but you kind of go to Italy and it's like, well, how do they do metros here? Why do they have a high speed rail? It's, well, you know, they've been kind of doing these things for a little bit longer. That may be a glib way of talking about it, but like, I think Ireland has a great opportunity. And I think for the most part, people are ready to capitalize on it. They, you know, people want a better country. And, you know, I think it's a little bit different than it was during the Celtic Tiger, where it was kind of, that was a real new money moment where it was kind
That's probably tearing you saying, Irish people are skiing. Can you?
yeah, exactly. And I think
are we not sort of like, we're the guy who got the money, right? And we're there, we're sitting there. And then other people have come along and said, well, there's sort of obligations that come with this money. Like, there's the whole military piece, there's the whole infrastructure piece. So, in other words, we want to be rich, but all this other stuff that comes with it, we don't want to know about that. So like with the Apple money column, right, we've got all this money, right, but we don't really know what to do with it, or how do you actually make it turn it into social progress or something that's long term and long standing, apart from
I think that the long term and the long standing piece is a really important point, and I'm fascinated and really grabbed by what John just said there. And I don't think we have a system, we haven't systemized strategic thinking or strategic planning in any meaningful way here at all. And if you think about how the political system here works, it's a very patronage-based system. You know, we look for our politicians to do us favors at the individual or local level, and then we reward that. We don't reward national level, strategic, vision-based politics. We just don't. We reward the guy who'll do the thing for us and who takes care of us and ours. And it's a very, I think, colonized as opposed to colonial way of thinking about things. The system exists not to serve us, but to exploit us. So how do I turn that back and exploit the system? That's how we survived under colonial rule. We need to recognize we're not anymore.
We are the colonial masters ourselves.
Now it needs to work for all of us. And our political system does not yet operate like that. And we are the biggest part of the problem there.
Joan,
so we don't think strategically and we don't reward big strategic...
I think that's a made well point. I mean, you look at the foreign piece, the diplomatic, the military. I mean, you see these stories about, you know, the Irish Navy have a gun, but there's nobody to fire the gun. And you see stuff like the RAF are flying here and the Royal Navy. So we're sort of still in that older 1950s mindset of kind of, well, you can't expect us to do any of this stuff. Like the British do all that. They patrol our waters. We've no radar. So we're sort of like, we have the cash, but we're not doing up the house.
Well, we want to be big when it suits us and we want to be small when it doesn't. And I do think... to the point of that, I agree with everything the guys have said. Like, you know, obviously we behave. I've written down the word trauma here. You know, you're talking about a relatively new country in a lot of respects. And then suddenly we got like, gosh, we're grown-ups now and we have money. And we kind of went a little bit crazy for a while and we bought a lot of short-term things. And now it's like, okay, now we've grown up and we've learned some lessons. So now we need to start thinking like adults, you know, and paying into a pension and stuff. So, you know, in the same way as that, you know, from on a national level, you know, we need to start investing strategically. And you're right, the political system doesn't support that. But even if it did, we don't seem to be very good at handling money. It's like, you know, it's like, so the first time you buy your first house and, you know, you're not very good at actually understanding how all these things work. And so we don't have the infrastructure there in place for it. So that's why you end up with huge wastages on things like bike sheds that went way over and children's hospitals that go way over. But to your point about where we take our international responsibility, I think it was acceptable in the past that we were neutral. When we were a small, independent new country that could barely look after itself and was trying to get its own house in order post-war of independence, I think it was not unacceptable that we would be neutral. But I don't think that Ireland in 2024 or going into 2025 with money, with one of the, you know, best, strongest economies, no matter what way you look at it, one of the strongest performing economies in Europe, we can now conveniently say, and other people's problems are their problems, we'll send you some cash, but we're not getting involved. You know, here's some Band-Aids. And I think we need to do more. We have a very strong diplomatic reputation. We have strong peacekeeping forces and a very strong reputation in that. But the idea of being neutral forever, it just
can I just extend that? I asked John, and I don't want to open up the whole Gaza police right now, but what I do want to make is a separate point, that is Ireland has taken, not a unique, but reasonably unique within Europe, stance on the recognition of Palestinian state. Is that part of what Joan is talking about? Like, as in, Ireland has taken a stance at all. Whether people agree or disagree, and there's all sorts of shades of grey in there. It's kind of like the first development of an independent Irish foreign policy of sorts. Is that a good thing in the sense that we're thinking about these issues? Or we're not just saying we're neutral and leave us alone, please?
I think it's an interesting point. I mean, I think it was hard for the international system to metabolize that. And I know Ireland wasn't alone. It was Norway and Spain, I think, were also involved in the unilateral recognition of Palestine. But I think that's an interesting point, that Ireland is trying to deploy moral capital as opposed to actual capital, right? And at some point, you do have to put your money on the table. And things like defense or having a robust foreign policy backed up by actual muscle, for me, is a question of self-responsibility and actual sovereignty. Like, real full sovereignty requires the ability to defend yourself and to project power, right? Ireland is trying to project power, and it's projecting it almost entirely in the moral sense.
The soft power stuff.
But I would argue has had zero impact on events in the place where it's trying to project that power. Now, I'm not saying we have to send like an aircraft carrier or whatever, a battle group or whatever to, you know, project force in the Middle East. I that's not exactly what I mean. But that to sort of be at the table where you're talking to the people who really do make those decisions and can project massive force.
You will be asked, where is your aircraft carrier?
And if you're not participating, you're just not in the conversation.
Colin, what about that? We're in a sort of moral universe and we're good at sort of signaling certain things. But when we get to the top table, people are going to say, you've no military, you've no infrastructure. So why would we listen to you?
I'm more than happy to criticize any Irish government for making decisions that are more about presentation than principle. But actually, I think on Gaza, the opposite is the truth. And I do think that's an example of not just Ireland standing for principles and standing for international humanitarian and human rights law and being clear in that position, but it was a risky proposition. And it is putting their money where their mouth is, because it is going to cost us money. Mm. We are being told repeatedly by the US and by others that it will have an impact upon us economically, and we're doing it anyway. Mm. And that's a very principle. The Occupied Territories Bill and the position generally on the conflict
brought me to a nice junction point, which is we're going to go into Trump, Sunak, Starmer, Musk, etc. after this short break. Now, as I said, we're looking and dissecting 2024. We're shooting forward as well into 2025. I've three amateur psychologists here who are putting it up on the couch and looking at all its innards. I've John Isle, who is the Deputy Business Editor of the Sunday Times Irish Edition. I've Joan Mulvihill, who's an artist and digitalization lead at Siemens. And I've Colm O'Gorman, who's a human rights campaigner and Irish Examiner columnist. Right, folks, this is it. This is the moment we go into it, right? We put on our our overalls and we look at what happened in the United States of America, which, of course, has all sorts of global implications. The election, which the bookies had as a tight one in the end, John, it was pretty clear. Popular vote win and electoral college vote win for Donald Trump. I don't think Kamala Harris ever got the separation in the polls that she was probably looking for. And we're already talking about Greenland being invaded. We're talking about the Panama Canal being taken over. Is Trump 2.0 going to be a lot more impactful than the first version, do you think? Or is it because he doesn't need to be re-elected this time? Is he going to sort of become, within a year or two, a little bit of a lame duck?
He's a little bit of a lame duck already. I mean, I think he's as... I'll just put my political cards on the table here. I think he's as dangerous as he ever was, right? And we kind of can see that in this transition period. I mean, the United States is unusual for having this long period between the election and the government actually taking their seats. But we've seen Trump kind of disregard constitutional norms by acting as if he's the president already, refers to himself as the president, takes meetings with international leaders, is trying to box around Justin Trudeau and president of Mexico, is already trying to exert influence on global events, interfering in Gaza hostage negotiations and ceasefire agreements and all this kind of stuff, which is highly irregular, let's say. And right beside him, he has his co-president, Elon Musk, right? Which has never been seen
before. I'm glad you got his official title correct.
Never been seen before in American politics. Meanwhile, Joe Biden has just kind of faded into the wallpaper in the White House. It's a really, I think, politically dangerous moment for the United States because the democratic norms have eroded so quickly. And I think that's the real issue about Trump's second term, is he's kind of done it once before. And, you know, he'd kind of like it was done more or less by the book. He was a sort of an outrageous.
Well, the January 6th stuff wasn't by the book. But, yeah.
Sorry, but it was like a presidency full of outrages that more or less stuck to the law. Right. That it doesn't look like that.
More or less is doing a lot of work.
It doesn't look like anything that's going to happen.
Okay, but there's two sort of schools of thought. One is, look, you know, he's going to do this stuff. He's going to be a lot worse this time, more pernicious. He really wants to make a mark this time. And he did, as you said, there were a few constraints around him the first time. That's one school.
Yeah.
The second one is, look, he'll say anything. He got in. He's going to be, you know, in there for 2 years. Then there'll be J.D. Vance or whoever will come on. The wall was never fully built. The tariffs will happen, but not quite as badly. So what do you think of that second group who are looking at it more benignly?
So what I think has been interesting already is looking at the catastrophe of the budget negotiations that happened just before Christmas, right? Where Trump attempted to throw his weight around. And it turns out that the Republican Party is not completely united behind him and that there's a lot of factionalism within the party. There are a lot of people who can't be controlled. There are other power centers within the Republican Party. So I think what will be interesting is to watch the conflict within the Republican Party and how that shapes the presidency moving forward.
Joan, as John said, there's an orbit around Trump, a certain set of characters. We've got Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos is kind of floating around. Mm-hmm. There's more shadowy figures like Peter Thiel, which is a very interesting and eccentric individual. They're known collectively as the Brolocracy, is the term that has been used. But, I mean, these people have been around for a long time. They've obviously grown the internet, they've grown social media, but now they're right, as John said, at the nerve centre of politics. Does that make you nervous?
It's been making me nervous for over a decade. I wrote a paper in 2011 called Digital Colonialism, where I called out that large technology companies had now more influence than government, and government were effectively resigned to low-level admin, and these guys were pulling all the strings. I'm particularly concerned about Peter Thiel, and I think these guys are absolutists, Elon Musk as well. So Elon Musk, if you study him, he's an absolutist around freedom of speech. I have no problem with freedom of speech, but, you know, and that old line of sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never hurt me. That was fine until the names were a pile-on in social media. And now we have young people dying by suicide because of the impact of social media, seriously impacting their mental health. But, you know, always about freedom of speech, the idea of alternative truths, alternative facts. That's all about freedom of speech. You can say whatever you like now. He's an absolutist. Peter Thiel is an absolutist as well. And he is an absolutist around capitalism and the role of the entrepreneur. He's the one who guided Mark Zuckerberg in the way that Facebook is set up so that Mark Zuckerberg, the entrepreneur, has absolute control and retains all of the autonomy. So he is an absolutist and an extremist. Now, if we look at, and I always talk about this as a comparison, I have no problem with religion. I have a problem with extremism. I think extremism of any form, whether it's extreme far right, to talk about that term again, but evangelical Christianity in America is just as bad as extremism when you're talking about, extremism in the Middle East. So whatever it is, whether it's extreme Islam or extreme Christianity, extremism is bad. And now we've got this situation, we've got absolutist and extremism around capitalism. And so that is serving the people who are the super wealthy in America. And I think that is the problem. And I think that's the thing that drove a lot of what happened in the election of Donald Trump. I remember thinking about afterwards, somebody had made a comment. I said, oh, America has just revealed to us who they really are. And I said, I don't think they have. I think a certain portion of people are going to vote Republican, a certain amount are going to vote Democratic. But in the middle, there was a load of people who are living in such abject poverty. They showed us how poor they are. They showed us that actually they are so desperate and so poor and so marginalized that they will vote for a man who has insulted them, maligned them, in every possible way. Okay. And they will vote for him because he will give them
something. Colm, I want to bring you into this as well.
Jobs and money, and all Kamala Harris was offering was unicorns, dreams and hope.
I suppose that's very interesting, but I'm kind of almost more interested. No, I like it, but I want to broaden it out, which is that circle around Trump, these brolocracy type individuals, which Joan has mentioned, Peter Thiel and a few others. And now people might say, oh, we don't like them. I understand all that. But getting them out of the system, whether it's via regulation or laws, it looks like a forlorn hope. In other words, they have the money, they have the infrastructure, and now they have the president. So they ain't going nowhere.
Yeah, exactly. There's not. I don't know why anybody would imagine we're going to get them out of the system when they now control the system. And they are the system. By the way, just I agree with much of what's just been said, but Elon Musk is not a free speech absolutist. He's a free speech absolutist as long as you're saying things that he approves of. You know, go on his platform now, the now largely neutered, pointless X, and use a word like cis, for instance, which is just a descriptive word, and you'll be you risk being banned from his platform. So he's not a free speech absolutist. He's an authoritarian. On the election outcome, I do think what was interesting about the popular vote was, from my memory of it, the Trump's vote did not increase on 2020, but the Democratic vote went down by about 10 million votes. Mm. So it was a Democratic collapse.
Yeah, the
it was a Democratic vote, collapse rather than a Trumpian surge. But I do think Trump is way more dangerous this time than he was last time, because now he knows what to do. Trump is going to start to burn things down on day one of that administration, and he knows how to do it.
I
remember, just one quick anecdote, I remember meeting with a very high-level US government official just after the 2016 election, and they were being very undiplomatic in how they, which was unusual for them, right? And they said, look, people shouldn't be too anxious. The US state is a massive ship. No one person can turn it around quickly. And he was right and he was wrong, because Trump did things during that first term that would have been unimaginable and should not have been possible had the levers been there to correct his excesses. He now effectively has the US Supreme Court completely behind him. Mm. Look what they did in relation to the criminal cases against him. So he has massive control. Okay, but even more than that, he now knows what to do. He's going to start to burn things down on day
John,
one of that.
I want to bring John in on this. I'm going to try and be an antidote to, I happen to generally agree with Colin, but I'm going to just put the other case, because that's my job, which is that, and I'm looking at Britain here in particular. So I'm going to look at the Liz Truss thing, right? And I'm going to say, what happened to Liz Truss? And you might say, where are you going with Liz Truss here? My point is, Liz Truss overreached, right? She went too far. She got the financial markets irritated. They got worried. The amount of debt Britain was building up, that budget she brought out that wasn't properly vetted. And the Tories overreached. They were flung out, not very convincingly, but they were flung out nevertheless. The Labour government has come in. Now, bringing it forward to the US, could Musk, could Trump and the Peter Thiels that Joan is mentioning, etc., is the biggest danger to them now their own hubris and overreach, where they just think we can blast through the Federal Reserve, the markets, global forces. In other words, are they almost at their point of weakness, because they're at their greatest point of strength now, that they just not open to any counter narrative at all? So they're going to get sloppy. They're going to get careless. Am I dreaming?
No, I certainly think they'll be sloppy. The weakness in the American system is that there isn't a mechanism to stop a president once he's been elected. And we saw that in Trump's first
term. But you could have market reaction.
But Trump was impeached twice, but not removed. Okay. So like he did the things, you know, that like the Truss thing, but with Liz Truss in the Conservative Party, they said, she's a disaster, let's get her out. And they did it themselves. That can't or won't happen in the American system. I think the big issue with the US is that, you know, the dollar's the reserve currency. The entire world economy depends on American productivity. Other countries will fall in line. Like, you'll see it here. You'll see how the political system here will have to accommodate itself to Donald Trump. So there isn't exactly, you know, people make sort of glib or flippant comparisons, you know, between Trump and Nazism, let's say, for instance. But what was the corrective mechanism against Nazism? It was the massive combined power of the United States and the Soviet Union. Well, where is the corrective mechanism that sits outside the United States that can possibly influence what happens there? I just don't see it.
I think the whole...
Curious about what their end game is. So we talked about Irish politics here and how we need to have, you know, better longer-term strategic thinking. And I think, you know, for me, Donald Trump is... And this is where I was trying to get to, and I meandered, but the idea of Peter Thiel is an absolutist around capitalism. You know, Donald Trump is a perfect vehicle for them because that's who he is. It's all about money.
We're going to have a lot of listeners currently Googling Peter Thiel.
Yeah, but the thing is, what is their end game? Like, where are these guys going with this? Like, when we think about legacy and the future of our country, they're not interested in climate crisis. Absolutely not.
Well, they're interested in power, right?
They're interested in power. But
holding it, keeping
it. And holding it, keeping it. But like, to what end?
Well, to the accumulation of wealth to the development of legend.
Yeah.
Right?
You know,
so they're messianic in their view of themselves.
These are like,
their egos that
these
drive.
These are like super Marvel comic villains. Like, you know.
Okay, well, listen, I'm going to deprive oxygen to all of them because I'm going to move on. I have to move on. I'm under pressure. So Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, goodbye for the moment. I want to talk a little bit about something a bit uplifting. So we've obviously got the Olympics and all of that, and I'm not going to go into that right now. But one of the things that came across to me during the year, and it's a cultural phenomenon, and it's kind of like the year of the Irish. Okay, remember we were early on, John was saying we're nothing unique about it, but I'm going to try and turn that on its head. The profusion of acting success, Hollywood success, cinematic success, it just keeps coming in waves. We've got Cillian Murphy, Paul Mescal, Andrew Scott, Eve Ewson, Sharon Horgan, Saoirse Ronan. I mean, you just go on and on and on and on. Now, maybe it's just it was a good year and it was a nice batch, a good vintage, but there's nothing. But there's a whole Guinness thing, a shortage of Guinness. There's all this Irish stuff is in at the moment, right? Mainly because of our younger people, right? This isn't sort of middle-aged people that are... Is this... Column, something culturally significant, or is it just look, a few of them got lucky on a few movies and there's nothing else going on here? Or is Irish currently voguish, do you think?
I hate the notion of it being voguish. I actually do think there's something deep in Irish culture that lends itself to this kind of success in the artistic arena. And I actually think it goes back to both our culture and our language. I mean, there's a reason, for instance, why we produce so many brilliant writers. It's because we speak, even if we don't speak Irish, we speak English in Irish. And Irish is an incredibly lyrical, musical, descriptive language. If you look at great Irish writers, they write with a turn of phrase that is much closer to how one might speak in Irish than they do in English. And I think that feeds itself through into all areas of artistic expression. So I do think you can hit a space where there's development. And actually, I'm having a senior moment now. What's the theatre school, the acting school in Trinity that came out a few years ago? Paul Mescal went there. Lots of this stable of new Irish actors. No, it's not called the Lyric. It's something like that.
Okay.
Come back. Somebody will tell me in a moment what it is. But there have been developments in that space where you're seeing now schools of acting develop, where you're seeing, you know, threads of artistic and creative expression come through that are feeding and building a momentum in the Irish sphere. And actually, if we look back at one of the big successes of the last government in this space, Catherine Martin's introduction of a wage, like a universal income for actors. That's for artists.
I need one for broadcasters.
That's going to, I think, really help to develop that creative.
Okay,
one of the areas in which we can.
Okay, hold that thought, because we do have to take a quick break and we'll pick up the threads from there. We're heading into the final part of our programme, dissecting and looking over 2024 and casting into 2025. In my studio here with me is John Isle, who is the Deputy Business Editor of the Sunday Times. Joan Mulvihill, right? Yeah. Artist and Digitalisation Lead at Sabins. And Colm O'Gorman, Human Rights Campaigner and Irish Examiner columnist. All three of you very welcome along. Colm, just to get started on something that's kind of interesting, we have a presidential election in 2025. Already got runners and riders. Anyone fancy Micheál Martin, Mairead McGuinness, Fergus Finlay, Bertie Ahern, Emily O'Reilly, Mary McCallan, Tommy Tiernan? These are Paddy Power odds, or sorry, Boyle Sports, apologies, Francis Fitzgerald and John Finucane. Are you greatly excited about any of those names?
Well, the first thing is I don't see a chance in hell of Micheál Martin running for the Oras next time out. So I think that can be discounted for a start. I also think these kinds of lists are interesting and obvious. And frankly, I don't mean the people, by the way, to be really clear,
but
this kind of speculation is of itself a little bit dull. Like, six of the names on this list have been cited in every presidential election by exactly this kind of commentary from 2011 onwards, or earlier actually, from 2004 onwards, about six of them. It's hard to know how it's going to play out. I would see either Mairead McGuinness or Francis Fitzgerald being the Fine Gael candidate. I have a funny feeling Francis Fitzgerald might even shade it within Fine Gael if it were to come to that, if she were to stand. It's a hard one to call. I'm not sure that Fergus Finlay will go again. He clearly when I say that Fergus wants the job, I actually think Fergus wants to do the job. And you know, cards on the table, I think he'd be a fine president. I think he'd bring something to it.
You're not going for Bertie Ahern then, no?
I don't think Bertie has rehabilitated himself sufficiently, and I don't mean that in a sneery way.
Yeah.
But he's been trying hard,
but I just think it's a dull idea, right? I
mean,
I think,
me and John were around for the financial crash, so we still have the receipts of what happened.
I think we need, I mean, the presidency has become something that leads from a place of vision. It has a very
let's put it aside.
I'm trying to see where the tension
is. It's not till next November, so we've a long way to go. Joan, the other one that's, we get sort of recency bias a little bit, I suppose, when we review news, but in the last few weeks, the French rape trial, Gisèle Pelicot, I mean, it's still in the news now, it's still reverberating because it's an extraordinary story on one level. This poor woman drugged by her own husband and various French men in that region then involved in some terrible sexual assault crimes, etc. From there, what do you make of it all? I mean, is it, in one sense, it's an interesting case. Obviously, it's so freakish, you know, just the details and the nature of it. The French system, they only have a certain amount of sentencing they can give, which it seems a lot of Americans I know were like, that is a light sentence for what happened, right?
Yes.
But what are the wider reverberations, in your opinion, on this?
I mean, the wider reverberations are her own words, which is the shame has got to shift from the victim to the perpetrators of the crime. She walked out of that courtroom, waived her anonymity and said, I have nothing to be ashamed of. And I think that is a really, really powerful message. I walk out of a courtroom, this has happened to me, and I have nothing to be ashamed of. And these men do. So you shift the shame onto them. They walk down the street, they hang their heads in shame. Not me. She walked out of there with her head held high. And that was such a courageous act. And I think the other takeaway from that story was the number of men that was involved in a relatively small geographical area, you know, that a man could go online and say, hi, here I am, this is the offer, and 52 people could show up going, yeah, I'm game for that. Like, I mean, that is horrific. That is just horrific. And so I think they are the two main elements. But for me, the big takeaway, and that's why so many people are hailing this woman as an absolute hero, is that she just said, the story from all of this, why I do this, is because I want to make it really clear. This is an opportunity to say the shame is not mine, it is theirs.
Yeah, and unfortunately, because of our very conventional time, because we probably need to do more on it and give it more time, but I have to move on. John, one of the things that comes across, and I suppose it's quite a big tone change from the last item, but it's just this whole idea of pricing how we spend our leisure time, the whole concert phenomenon. I mean, it just everyone wants to hear live music for whatever reason. Suddenly, maybe it's a COVID-related phenomenon, but then we kind of get grouchy about how much we're having to pay. Mm. There's this whole concept of dynamic pricing, which was kind of associated with Uber. If you wanted to get a taxi, now it's in the whole concept. It's pretty simple phenomenon in the sense you pay more when there's more demand there, right?
Yeah.
But we don't like that. We like the older model. So is this just a load of middle class people being a bit sort of annoyed about their money, or is there something else going on here deeper in
society? No, I don't think so. I mean, what you're seeing is like you're seeing a demonstration of what happens when you have a free market, right? A pure free market. That winds up being controlled by a monopolist, right? So let's not forget how
monopolization.
Yeah, let's not forget how music promotion works. There isn't like, you know, a dozen promoters scrapping to do the business. There's kind of one and a half, right? So that's sort of how it works. And then you also have massive scarcity in the live music space. There are only a few acts globally that really attract attention. And partly because of the globalization of media and social media, the ones at the top are the biggest. You know, they're like Taylor Swift is like the Elon Musk in terms of like size and wealth.
That's a terribly unfair analogy. But
I don't mean in terms of opinion, but in terms of like how much attention
market
she
power,
attracts, market power, etc. So there isn't a lot of diversity in live music. So these acts come around. Everybody,
what do you say to someone who says, look, if you can't afford to go and see Oasis or Taylor Swift, just go and see your local band who will charge you a tenner? What's the big deal?
So I learned something interesting about Taylor Swift. My daughter spent 300 odd euros on a ticket to Taylor Swift. And she said the Aviva was full of Americans who had flown over, right? So she was down on the floor in one of the exclusive areas or whatever. Americans who had flown over, like super rich Americans who were following Taylor Swift around the world, hoovering up tickets, hoovering up hotel spaces, booking tables in restaurants, etc. spending money that most other people don't have so they can see Taylor Swift a dozen times on the same tour. So what you're seeing is the sort of the same economic dynamics that are happening in other parts of the market, which is that the rich people are taking everything and leaving very little for the rest of us, right? So, like...
But what can you do about that? Well, stadiums have only certain...
No, monopoly should be regulated, right? Mm. Monopoly should be regulated. So this is a problem of, like, market pricing power, right? You have a company like Live Nation that can more or less set the price. Oh, we'll do dynamic pricing. Also, we'll
have... What are you talking about? Price
controls? No. I'm talking about you can only have a certain amount of the market, not price controls. You can only own a certain amount of the market.
So how would that work? You should only do a certain number of stadiums?
No, not Taylor Swift. I'm talking about whoever the artist is, right? Yeah, like anyone. You break them up. You say...
You have to competition between various parties.
From the person who's charging the lowest price for the ticket.
But you're talking about the tickets vendor, right?
And you can also regulate the practices. For instance, the same companies that are selling the tickets have a subsidiary that has a bot that buys up all the tickets and then sells them on a secondary market. Right? That's price fixing. Like, for God's sake, like, what are we allowing here?
Colin, Oasis sort of didn't seem to be overly sympathetic to all this complaints. I think one of the Gallagher brothers, I won't repeat it, but he pretty much just said F off to his own fans, which is kind of a Gallagher brothers thing. what do you think of all this? Is this something that you wouldn't rank that highly? Or do you kind of think, well, no, there's real life issues here? Or is it like, you know, somebody can't get to a concert? There's a lot more important things in our lives than that.
I find it depressing.
You didn't get a ticket.
I wouldn't. Like, there's no way I'm going to spend...
Are you going to Oasis?
I'm not. No, God, no.
But would you have an interest?
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, I liked Oasis when they were around in the early days of Oasis and then got very bored of them very quickly. And if I wanted to pay to see an older man whine upwards into a microphone wearing a parka, I wasn't going to pay €300 or €400 to do so. Like, I just don't think they're that great.
When you put it like that.
but like, the bottom line is I would not pay €300 to go and see anybody. I just think it's an obscene amount of money. But I am very worried about that idea that now access to culture at that level, which is presented in the media and social media space as being the great desirable, this is how you are somebody if you go to these things, that again, more and more people are being priced out of that. So we're marginalising and excluding more and more people from cultural
expression. But on a happy note.
Oh, hang on, a happy note. Hang on, hold this moment.
Taylor brought so much joy to so many people this summer. And I've got to say, I mean, I didn't go, but I really wish I had. And I know the people who went, Irish people who went, Irish young girls and their mothers, friends of mine who went. And it was a joyful,
amazing
experience that was uplifting.
Well, to be fair, neither Colm or John fulfilled the standard profile of a Taylor Swift fan.
I'm not sure that I necessarily do either.
I think they both accept
I do think she brought a great deal.
You have to hold that thought because we're out of time. Oh. Go out on a high. Thank you to all three of you. John Eilley, who's the Deputy Business Editor of the Sunday Times. Irish Edition, Joan Mulville, who's on a high with Taylor Swift. She's also the digitalisation lead at Siemens. And Colm O'Gorman, human rights campaigner and avowed enemy of Oasis, the rock band. All three of you, thank you very much for joining me.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. If approved, applications are typically funded the next business day or sooner. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit. Credit to the people.